being an independent woman and all of a sudden entering to the situation where they have to be dependent to the male family members.
For Afghan women, U.S. departure marks a new era of uncertainty. It's Tuesday, September 7th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Amy Heibels in Washington. You can also find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Afghans face internal displacement crisis. U.S. president to travel to Northeast U.S. to see storm damage. And remembering 9/11, what does 9/11 mean to young New Yorkers? Limiting presidential war-making powers. And veteran says U.S. overextended stay in Afghanistan. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The Taliban said on Monday they've taken control of Panjshir province north of Kabul, the last holdout of anti-Taliban forces in the country, and the only province the Taliban had not taken control of in Afghanistan last month. Meanwhile, in an audio message on his Facebook page, resistance leader Ahmad Massoud said his forces are still present in Panjshir and will continue to fight the Taliban. On Saturday, Taliban fighters in Kabul forcefully broke up a protest by a group of women demanding equal participation in the government. The Taliban imposed a brutal justice system and banned women from work and prevented older girls from receiving an education when the group previously seized power. Taliban leaders, however, have promised to install an inclusive government in Kabul that they say will allow women to work and receive an education within the framework of Islamic law or Sharia. As VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports, there are already signs that their rights are in danger.
Taliban fighters celebrated with gunfire and swooped into the Kabul airport as the last U.S. service members left Afghanistan. For Afghan women, the U.S. departure marks a new era of uncertainty and fears of what lies ahead. The Taliban have promised women certain rights under the framework of Islam. However, basic rights like going to school or work could soon be taken away. In the western city of Herat, Afghan women staged a defiant protest, demanding the right to work and representation in the Taliban's new government. Lena Haidari is a government school teacher.
I want to say that I was forced to stay at home for the crime of being a student 20 years ago, and now, 20 years later, for the crime of being a teacher and a woman.
State Department spokesperson Ned Price had this to say.
What we will be looking to when it comes to the issues that you've raised, including the potential for any forms of assistance, will be the actions of any new Afghan government, especially vis-a-vis the areas we care profoundly about. That is safe passage, respect for the rights of the people of Afghanistan, including women and girls and minorities, a government that is inclusive.
U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen told a Washington Post forum that the Doha Agreement, negotiated between the Trump administration and the Taliban in 2020, provided no guarantees of an inclusive government or protections for the rights of women. Democratic United States Senator Jeanne Shaheen.
I raised concerns with former Secretary Pompeo, with Ambassador Khalilzad, that women were not represented at the table, despite the fact that we have legislation on the books signed by former President Trump that says in conflict areas, women should be at the negotiating table when we are negotiating the end to the dispute. And those messages fell on deaf ears. So now we are dealing with a situation where women and girls were not represented at the table, and there are no assurances for them going forward.
A former Afghan judge living in exile told that same forum what she is hearing from women activists still in Afghanistan.
They are depressed. They are helpless. They cannot help themselves, not only themselves, but also they become dependent. That's also a kind of a way of how they see themselves being an independent woman, and all of a sudden entering to the situation where they have to be dependent to the male family members.
Many fear the Taliban will return to the brutal way they ruled the country from 1996 until the U.S. drove them out in 2001. Tara DeMont is with Amnesty International USA.
They banned almost all education for women and girls. They imposed punishments, including stoning and lashings. And they confined women to their homes unless they were accompanied by a male escort. And there's a real fear that this type of repression or versions of this could come back.
The very real threats to the lives of Afghan women activists demand action by the Biden administration. Tara DeMont of Amnesty International tells VOA.
For some Afghan women, for some Afghan women's rights defenders, safety is going to look like a refugee, being a refugee and being an asylum seeker in the United States or in other countries.
For now, many Afghan women are left to stay and fight for their rights. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
You can learn more about our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Curtain divides male-female students as Afghan universities reopen. Taliban pledge safety for humanitarian workers, UN says. Taliban stop planes of evacuees from leaving, but unclear why. Hundreds of thousands of Indian farmers rally against farm laws. China turns to rap to promote policies at home and abroad. For additional coverage of these stories and more, go to Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The UN Refugee Agency warns millions of Afghans displaced by conflict inside their country are teetering on the brink of a humanitarian catastrophe and need international aid to survive. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An estimated 3.5 million Afghans have been uprooted by conflict and insecurity, including more than 500,000 newly displaced people this year. Women and children account for most of the internally displaced people. The UN Refugee Agency has predicted about 500,000 Afghans will likely flee to neighboring countries in search of asylum. However, UN observers at Pakistani and Iranian border points report that a large-scale refugee influx so far has not materialized. Speaking on a video link from the Pakistan capital, Islamabad, UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says his agency is trying to analyze why so few people are coming.
There could be many, many reasons, but the reality is the displacement crisis is inside Afghanistan. What we have seen where the crisis has been an internally displacement crisis, and that's why we keep repeating that let's not allow it to become a humanitarian catastrophe so we are able to support the Afghans inside their country, the support they need.
Baluch says the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan remains open to commercial trade between the two countries. He says a limited number of Afghan pedestrians cross every day. That flow, he says, is very regulated and managed at the border. He says people who have passports, visas, or other documents they can show are allowed to enter. He says an increasing number of Afghans who have arrived in Pakistan have been telling his colleagues their reasons for coming.
It's insecurity and their intention to seek asylum once they're here, but the movement, the back and forth movement is very mixed. A lot of trade going, commercial activities, many people come in terms of trying to seek medical attention on this side.
Baluch says it is crucial Afghanistan not become a forgotten crisis. He says the UNHCR is appealing to the world not to turn its attention away from the Afghan people. He says international support is needed to keep the Afghan people from leaving home. He appeals to the international community not to allow Afghanistan's internal displacement crisis to become a humanitarian catastrophe. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still ahead on VOA Asia. The U.S. president travels to New York and New Jersey this week to see damage caused in the aftermath of Hurricane Ida. Happening now in Asia. Vietnam's capital, Hanoi, on Monday extended COVID-19 restrictions for another 2 weeks as authorities launched a plan to test up to 1.5 million people for the infection in higher-risk areas amid a climb in cases. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Thank you for spending time with us today on VOA Asia. U.S. President Joe Biden is set to travel this week to New York and New Jersey to survey the damage caused by the remnants of Hurricane Ida. The system made landfall in Louisiana last Sunday, but worked its way up the East Coast, causing tornadoes, fatalities, and leaving millions without electricity. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Post-storm cleanup efforts are underway in New York and New Jersey. Last week, Hurricane Ida pummeled Louisiana, leaving millions in the region without power, some possibly for weeks. Louisiana's governor says the 16 years and billions of dollars invested by the federal government after Hurricane Katrina came ashore in 2005 meant a fortified levee system that kept the bad situation from being much worse. President Biden visited Louisiana Friday to see the damage firsthand.
To date, we've also provided $100 million in direct assistance directly to folks in Louisiana with that $500 going into their bank accounts so that they can deal immediately with emergencies.
Climate scientists say to expect more severe storms as ocean temperatures continue to climb. Sunday on ABC's This Week, Cedric Richmond, senior advisor to the president, called for action on climate change.
These once-in-a-century storms are starting to come almost every other year. They're bigger, they're stronger, they wreak more havoc. If you look at New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, people should see what the climate change is doing, and we're going to address that in our legislation.
But for now, millions remain without electricity, and long lines at gas stations in southern Louisiana are common, with generators being the only source of power for many homes in the region. Louisiana Republican Senator Bill Cassidy praised the federal government's response, but told ABC's This Week his state needs more help.
The federal partners have been there, and so I compliment the federal partners, and I thank them for that. But we need gasoline, and we need electricity, and we need housing. And then we need to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill for the long term. So on the other hand, telling people it gets better when they're told they won't have electricity back until September the 29th is cold comfort.
Ida worked its way north from its Louisiana landfall, causing at least four dozen fatalities, many due to intense flooding in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. In Manville, New Jersey, residents are still picking up the pieces in disbelief at the damage the storm left behind.
Manville is crazy right now. Like, it's a lot of people, hardworking people are living here. Everybody, the town is very amazing. Everybody likes to help each other out. But this just came out of nowhere. Nobody knew it. Just came out of nowhere.
Zeb says his realtor told him the property was at some risk for floods, but that they'd likely never experience one. But just 8 months later, as Ida moved through town, Zeb says the storm destroyed the cars he uses for business, and it dumped at least 4.5 meters of water into his home. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Be sure to read and see more on this story at VOA Asia Facebook.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
From VOA Asia. In the Philippines, some COVID-19 restrictions in the Manila region will be relaxed from Wednesday, with plans to shift to smaller localized lockdowns going forward if needed, according to a presidential spokesperson. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. All this week, VOA Asia remembers the events and effects of 9/11 as it approaches the 20th anniversary on Saturday of the terror attack on the United States. They were too young to remember the 9/11 attacks or were born in the years after, but they all grew up in a city coping with the aftermath. What does 9/11 mean to New York City's young adults and teenagers? VOA's Tina Trin has more.
Noah Rodriguez was only 2 at the time. But he thinks about 9/11 as the day the earth stood still, everyone watching as the Twin Towers burned.
And that was important because there's a level of humility to that, and I don't think that's going to be forgotten as much.
The attacks on the World Trade Center undoubtedly changed New York City, but for those who were children during 9/11 or born shortly thereafter, there's some ambivalence as the 20th anniversary approaches.
I think most kids, like, they understand conceptually what happened and they can understand that it was a tragedy, but it's not the same thing as living through it.
For 16-year-old New Yorker Sarah Malik, 9/11 is a secondhand experience, one told to her by her dad, who worked near the Twin Towers.
I just think that many of them don't know. It's not that they know, but they don't care.
Joan Mastropolo of the 9/11 Tribute Museum says the events and their aftermath can become real for younger generations when they hear the stories of survivors.
I mean, when I tell them what I saw, what I experienced, what I smelled.
For 17-year-old Silvana Davi, the day is personal. Her mother was supposed to be in the Twin Towers when the plane struck.
If my mom did go, I wouldn't be here.
Growing up in a New York suburb where many lost parents, the attack has been a backdrop to her life. She recently wrote a paper about it for her history class.
I feel like it should never be forgotten, and the new generations that are coming in should learn about it as it is a part of our history.
She's also raising money for a 9/11-related charity. As the country marks the 20th anniversary, future generations will define for themselves what 9/11 means to them.
America is burning in a lot of different ways. Like, I don't know why people have been so focused on this in the grand scheme of things.
Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
Making headlines in Asia, hundreds of supporters of two Canadian men being held on what Ottawa says are specious charges marched 7,000 steps through the Canadian capital Sunday to mark the pair's 1,000th day of detention in China. Similar events in support of Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig were held elsewhere in Canada and across the world. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, one of the lasting legacies of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks may finally be repealed by U.S. lawmakers seeking to limit presidential war-making powers. The 2001 and 2002 authorizations for the use of military force for the war on terror have been a subject of heated debate on Capitol Hill almost since they were passed. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
U.S. forces attacked while evacuating Americans and Afghan allies out of Kabul, bringing the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan to a close nearly two decades after the U.S. Congress gave the White House the power to wage war there. Authorizations that also covered the conflict in Iraq and then stretched to include engagements ranging from Syria to Yemen to the strike against Iranian General Qasem Soleimani.
Over 20 years, successive administrations have interpreted and reinterpreted the text of that resolution to use it in new countries against an expanding list of loosely connected groups. This process has all but cut Congress out of its fundamental responsibility to decide issues of war and peace.
Under the U.S. Constitution, Congress has the power to declare war, but the 2001 and 2002 authorizations of use of military force gave U.S. presidents broad powers to engage overseas.
Presidents increasingly go it alone and tell Congress the bare minimum about military actions. Presidents and their lawyers look to a 20-year-old authorization of force to justify their actions. If we do nothing, we shouldn't be surprised by the outcome.
Earlier this year, before the evacuation of Kabul, the White House signaled it was willing to work with Congress to repeal those authorizations in favor of a narrower framework.
They should include concrete consequences, like a funding cutoff with a shorter clock. Put the president and executive branch officials on notice from the outset that if they can't get congressional support for their actions, their funding has an expiration date.
Past efforts to repeal the authorizations have met with opposition from presidents on both sides of the aisle, as well as Republican criticism it could hamper the U.S. response to terrorist threats.
We have the same goal here. We may have just a little bit different means of getting about it. We should also avoid dismissive talk of forever wars because it implies that our ongoing counterterrorism engagements are illegal and unnecessary.
As a senator, Biden worked for greater congressional oversight over presidential war powers. Now that he's in the White House, there is a sense Congress can reassert control over one of its most important responsibilities.
There is a fundamental question of leveling with the American public and holding the president accountable for the justification that he or she proposes promises to provide.
A key Senate committee approved the repeals earlier this summer, clearing the way for a full floor vote when the Senate returns to work in Washington in September. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
In 2002, VOA's Kane Farabaugh, then a reporter for the U.S. military, visited Afghanistan in the early stages of America's nearly 20-year presence in the country. As the United States ends its military engagement, Farabaugh follows up with some of those he met in those early years to discuss the U.S. withdrawal and the legacy of their mission.
Well, we're here at Kabul International Airport where we...
My first visit in 2002, reporting for the American Forces Network from the newly liberated capital city of Kabul, Afghanistan.
Top jump master.
Started in U.S. Army Major Patrick Flanagan's military Humvee as we departed Bagram Airfield. The two-hour ride in a small convoy on a 60-kilometer stretch of highway cut through the remote countryside and brought Flanagan and his unit into contact with foreign troops, Northern Alliance fighters, and wary Afghan citizens.
I remember the first couple rides into Kabul, they say, oh, you're with the killers. And I'm like, the killers? They says, no, we're here to protect the city. You're here to kill the Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, the bad people.
That perception didn't meet the reality of this day's mission.
When the United States Army Psychological Operations teams go into stores like this one in Kabul, they've got several things in mind.
Our journey led us to Kabul's famed Chicken Street, where Flanagan's objective was to shop.
We're buying some school supplies, purchasing them to take them back up to our area in order for us to give them to the locals. And what we're going to do is give them to the local leaders in order to have them promote that, again, they're in charge of their schools and they want to take care of the pupils as well as the teachers that are working hard.
Delivering school supplies along with leaflets and other material labeled with slogans and messages was part of Flanagan's U.S. Army Psychological Operations, or PSYOP mission.
It's the military's form of influence.
Flanagan says the intent of PSYOP wasn't to mislead or indoctrinate, but to educate and protect.
It's not so much taking information, trying to use it for or against the population, but an appreciation, understanding of what they're going through so we can use the themes and symbols and messages to better assist themselves as well as the coalition forces.
Don't step on IEDs or report if there's an unexploded ordnance. So some of them was just to inform them because it could hurt them. But others is like, you know that the coalition, you shouldn't throw rocks at their trucks, or the coalition are friendly. So a whole series of messages designed to help them understand why we're here so they wouldn't have someone else to answer that question for them that really didn't like us.
Today, remnants of Flanagan's PSYOP mission are stored in his rural Virginia basement, memories of Afghanistan, where he lived and worked for a total of 2 years over multiple deployments, supporting a mission he sees today as incomplete.
And I think at times, because of some of our actions, we've hardened the people that don't like us. So I think it was polarizing. But then they were agitated by the Taliban, who say, we don't want you to help them. So they would think of new ways to cause havoc and chaos and pain.
Flanagan retired from the Army in 2011 and has spent time since working for a U.S. military contractor. Through his brother, former Illinois Congressman Michael Flanagan, now a Washington, D.C. consultant, he had opportunities to share his views on his time in Afghanistan with other legislators and policymakers.
I think we should have left a while ago. I think we overextended our stay.
Flanagan feels the U.S. achieved its goal of breaking up Osama bin Laden's terrorist operations in the country, but lost the effort to nation-build in Afghanistan. Now that the military is exiting, Flanagan wants a parade or celebration marking the return of U.S. forces back home.
Just to say thank you very much, and then when that's over, it kind of finalizes it and it's done. You can look back and say, okay, that's finished.
But Flanagan hopes to serve the public again. He is seeking opportunities to run for political office, where he hopes to use the experience he gained in Afghanistan while in uniform to shape future U.S. foreign policy.
Chuck.
Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Front Royal, Virginia.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. You can also follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thank you for stopping by, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Chris Cascale, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Amy Heibels in Washington. Please stay safe and make it a great day.